So tonight, as I said, I just changed it a little bit ago. So if I jumble around in my notes a little bit, I added a section and moved some sections. So you have to bear with me there. But we do live in an age where, what is the nickname for this right here? I know it's the Bible, the Word. I know it's the Word, but there's kind of a phrase that people would use to refer to this book. Do what? The Good Book, right? Well, that is not the way people talk anymore. In my grandparents' age, even some in my dad's age, definitely in my great-grandparents' age, there was just a general cultural reverence for the Bible where you don't ridicule it, you don't critique it. It doesn't mean everybody believed it. Don't get me wrong. That's not what I'm saying. But people would refer to it as like the good book. I mean, it's generally respected. That has gone out the window today. And it has flipped so far the other way that it has become what we may say is cool to discredit the Bible. The best-selling books, it seems, are the ones that take the Bible the least serious, the ones that can critique the Bible the most. And so, again, tonight I want to talk through some of the critiques that you'll hear. And part of this is, it is a difficult subject. That's why I reference you to other things that you can get more details in. But I'm looking at Courtney here. So Courtney is in church here, and eventually, children are like arrows, right? And arrows are meant to be stored. No, they're meant to be shot out. Get out. Go. So eventually she'll leave the quiver that is Jerry and Kim's house, right? And if we don't do our job to prep her for the best arguments for the other side, this is why you get this alarming statistic of how many Christians fall away and all this kind of stuff, because churches typically refuse to talk about hard things like this. Now, again, that doesn't mean I'll do an excellent job. It just means we're willing to try it at least. And the reason I say that is because a couple years ago, when I first taught this, it was back in 2015, there was a person going to our church at the time who just started at Wichita State, okay? And the dad called me up and said, hey, my daughter's taking these classes at Wichita. She thought it would be interesting to take a Bible class, but gets in the class and realizes this isn't like Bible study. This is let's critique the Bible, right? So he starts explaining to me some of the arguments the teacher was making, and I made the comment, oh, that sounds like so-and-so, a name I'll give you in a second. And I guess she heard me on the phone because she said, that's the book we're reading. And so I want to introduce you to a man. You may not have heard of him, but I promise you, you've tasted some of his fruit, if you will. He has spread himself throughout all the world, it seems. And anyone who attacks the New Testament borrows from this man named Bart Ehrman. Bart Ehrman, E-H-R-M-A-N. He's written several books. He teaches, he's professor of religious studies at UNC Chapel Hill. So pretty well-known university. Obviously, his teachings are well-known in the world. Some of you, like I said, have heard of him. Some haven't. He's actually from Lawrence, Kansas. He studied Greek and Hebrew at Moody Bible Institute. After Moody, he went on to graduate from Wheaton College. Then he went to seminary at Princeton. Again, you can see more of a liberal drift as he goes up in his degrees. He got a MDiv and a PhD, and it was during his studies at Princeton that he came across the issues that we're going to talk about tonight. The issues we'll talk about tonight caused him to question things in such a way that he completely rejected the trustworthiness of the Bible. I come to the same issues and walk away with complete trust in the Bible. So again, it depends on how you take the information. Eventually, he went from being a liberal Christian to just a flat-out agnostic. I would encourage you on YouTube, if you would like to, listen to the debate between Bart Ehrman and James White, or do Bart Ehrman and Dan Wallace. Both of those are very helpful for this. They are Greek nerds, and so there are some situations where you got to rewind it a couple times, go to Webster's a few times, and figure out what they're talking about. But it's helpful overall, and I have no issue saying today he is the leading critic of the New Testament. And this is, again, professor of religious studies at UNC Chapel Hill. his books were assigned at Wichita State, and I would imagine at several other universities across the nation. Again, some of you may think, what does this have to do with me? Well, again, in my grandparents' generation, where there's a general respect for the Bible, there's also this thing that's missing that's called the internet. With the internet, I mean, anybody can get on YouTube and say, can I trust the Bible? And who knows what in the world they're going to find. And so there's an accessibility to information which can be very good. And in this case, it can be very dangerous. And so we want to make you aware of what's going on with him. And so don't think his stuff's not going to affect us. It already has. And I promise you, if you have conversations at work, people who have never heard of this man borrow from him to argue against the Bible. And so you'll hear some of those arguments tonight as we go through this. So imagine tonight we're kind of gearing up for as you go out in the world and talk to coworkers and different people. So again, think about, if you will, this book I'm holding in my hand. We call it a Bible, and we studied 2 weeks ago how it was translated in English, how we got it into the versions we have today. But you got to think for a second, how did it actually get to us? This book wasn't made in heaven. Like this, there's a cow walking around the earth somewhere. I guess a goat, actually. There's a goat somewhere whose skin was given for this cover. And these pages came from some fine paper company. It didn't float out of heaven like this, is what I'm getting at. There was a process it went through for us to hold our Bibles in our hands. And so, what do you do with the fact that Bart Ehrman would say things like, did you know that we have zero original copies of our originals of what was written in the Bible? So the actual letter of Paul to the Romans, we do not have it. Like the actual one he wrote. Does that make sense? We call those autographs. When Matthew wrote his gospel, whatever he wrote that on, we do not have that anymore. You can go book by book through the whole Bible, and we don't have any of them. So what do you think the natural question is? Yeah, how do you know what you're reading is what a document you don't have originally said? I mean, it's a pretty logical question. How can you, it's not like we can point to the original and go, well, I know it says this because look at it, it says it. We don't have anything here. There's no letter from Paul to the Romans to go check our copies of Paul's letters to the Romans against. And so how you answer this matters. Again, not only do you have to wonder about not having any of the autographs, but we'll get into some of the details later. When you compare all the handwritten copies that we have, there are, conservatively, about 400,000 differences. When you think about that, I think the number is, I don't have it written down, I think that's like 3 differences for every word of the New Testament. Sorry, that doesn't look good. So again, how can you trust it? How can you trust a document that you don't have, and the only copies you have 400,000 differences? And so again, we got to think, how did we get our Bible? Why is it we can trust it? And I'll just tell you, we have our Bible today because people faithfully copied copies of the Bible. Whatever was originally written has been preserved through people making error-filled copies. And I don't want you to be alarmed by that. When Paul wrote, from then on, every copy, because it was done by human hands, that it was prone to errors. And so finding errors in the copy is not a problem. We'll talk more about why that is later. Again, how do we know that there are errors? If I've got 2 things that claim to be a copy of one thing and they differ, how do you know which one's right? If me and Jerry are sharing a story from something today and we tell it differently, how can you tell what happened if you weren't there? And this is what we're trying to deal with. So again, we got our Bibles the way we have them today because they were being preserved through people making copies that were prone to errors. And again, to make an exact copy of something, which is what Bart Ehrman demands. He says, look, if your Bible really was given to you by God, then it would have been perfectly written down and perfectly copied through the years. Well, it's like, well, that's what you think. Where'd you get that from? Why is that the only way God could inspire a text? Without admitting it, he sounds much more Muslim than he does Christian. The Islam, I don't know if you're aware of this, I forget the guy's first name, but it's Uthman is his last name. And there was a moment, and I forget when it was, but he took all of the handwritten copies of the Quran, gathered them together and burned them and made an official copy. So let me ask you a question. Are you thankful to have only one copy of the Quran? Now, I don't mean like, do you like having the Quran? That's not my point. But if you're a Muslim, are you glad? Man, we've got one copy. It's like, well, no. Because how do I know this guy got it right? I have nothing to compare it to now. And so we'll talk more about this kind of stuff. But Bart Ehrman, Islam, all these kind of things, they don't understand that God is able to both inspire written text and preserve that written text in copies that have errors. And we'll talk about why that is. Another line of argument is if you demand that perfect copies be made, when do you think we can start actually getting copies of the Bible? What has to be invented first? And I'm setting you up here. Huh? Time machine. Okay, then we still don't have a copy if that has to be invented. What'd you say? The perfect person? Okay. Think printing press, right? That's what a lot of people would answer. Well, if handwritten copies are problems, then the printing press, that would solve it. It's like, nope, we talked about this already. If you don't align the keys right, you get that one wrong. And that's why that one King James Bible says, thou shalt commit adultery. It's like you might want to throw the word not in there. It might be a little more faithful to what it actually says. And so even with that, you could have errors. So honestly, until 1959, when Xerox was invented, that's when you could actually take something and copy it exactly as it is. So by Ehrman's standard, it's impossible to have reliable copies until 1959. No one deals with reality that way. So we have about 1,400 years. That's because print and press ended the handwritten copies being so popular. About 1,400 years of handwritten copies of the New Testament, and we're saying we can trust it, even though we're admitting there's 400,000 errors or variants in it, sorry. One of the things I want to clarify for you, because this is going to pop a lot of Bart Ehrman's bubbles, more so the bubbles that popped up with Da Vinci Code, things like that years ago. Sometimes people will say, look, the Bible, we will never know what it originally said. That's the argument Ehrman will use sometimes. Because the people who controlled the Bible changed it to say what they wanted it to say. So you'll never really get back to what it actually said. It's like, well, it might be helpful to realize there was no one group over the Bible at any one time. I have some slides, not tonight, but I can show you. When you talk about these copies of the New Testament, I'm dealing with New Testament primarily tonight. It's a whole other issue to deal with old. But if you deal with the New Testament, there's typically what we call four families of copies. And all that means is as the copies were being they're branching out in the world, there tends to be four areas in that area of the world where copies were being readily made. And they start to develop their own characteristics. It's kind of like with the Tower of Babel, you spread people out, and each people group kind of starts to develop their own characteristics. Well, when these copies start getting spread out, there's certain characteristics that are so similar, we kind of call those families, okay? What that helps us with is to understand, because they were so spread out, there was no one point in time where a building or an organization had complete control over every copy and can just change whatever they wanted to. And I'll give you an illustration later that'll help with this, but more copies are good for us because it helps us see what was added. If I have three copies, it's possible that these two get it wrong and this one got it right. But if I have 1,000 copies and one copy says one thing and 999 say another, that's easy to spot. And so more copies are actually good. I'll give you some more illustrations on that later. So again, often people will say, look, we'll never know what the Bible originally said because they changed it so much. There's no proof of that. There actually was no time where that could have been accomplished because people cared so much about copying the scriptures that there was no one time where someone dominated it in such a way they could change it without being exposed. And we'll talk more about this with some clear illustrations. Another example that people will give is, well, we don't know what the Bible originally says, and it's a lot like this telephone game. How do you play telephone? What do you do? Go ahead, help me out here. I know y'all have all played it. Okay, so a lot of people think Bible translation, Bible transmission is like the game of telephone, where I would give Colin a phrase, and he would whisper it, and it would snake its way on back to Mary here. And what do you think is going to happen by the time we get Mary? Yeah, it's going to be way different. It could be genuine errors. It could be Kyle thinks Robert changed something, and he knows Robert really well, so he probably changed this to this, so I'll change it back. Or it could be just some crazy jokers who go, I don't really care about transmitting this accurately. I'm just going to make up something. But by the time it gets to Mary, it ain't got a shot at being accurate, right? And so that's the way that people will say the Bible was transmitted and translated. You had Paul, what he wrote, but then after that, everybody kept copying each other. The error here is they assume there was only one line of copying, and copy number 37 had no access to these up here. Does that make sense? So imagine if we're playing telephone and all of a sudden Colin goes to talk to the Gilberts there and he just skips these people. It's like, well, yeah, we may have some confusion here, but you just had direct access to what you needed here. And then imagine if he does it again with Leah back there. When people were making copies, they didn't just wait on one person to get done and then make a copy of that one, wait on him to get done and then make a copy of that one. There was these branches of copies where multiple, we could say, generations of a copy were being made of a similar source. And then it may be two and three generations later where it doesn't mean the first century text got copied in the second century, got copied in the third, got copied in the fourth. It doesn't run through like a telephone game. There were people who had access to early documents and could bypass years of history in order to copy it. The other thing that, or I'm saying, with those two things, it's not a telephone game. It wasn't controlled by one group. You need to understand that's not how the New Testament was copied. The messages were passed on in writing. And again, there were multiple areas that we talked about with those families where they were being produced. And so Bart Ehrman will make the claim that they added stuff to the Bible or they changed it. But again, he never offers proof of that. And so given the amount of copies we have, and given the closeness of the copies, so again, normally when I would teach this, we would talk about how the event happening and the closeness of the copies is unparalleled with anything else in ancient history. You're doing good. Let's see. I do remember, with Josephus, I want to say we have 50 copies of Josephus. And the earliest is 900 years after what he wrote. So the best we can do with Josephus is get within 900 years and 50 copies. With the Bible, you've got 5,800, and our first ones go anywhere from 45 to 90 years after the events. And so it's just unparalleled in comparing it with ancient documents. So given the amount of copies we have, given the closeness of them to the autographs and the events, if you will, and given the widespread copying that was going on, we do have to consider the content of our copies, if you will. Just for your record, these are not exact numbers, but if we just count the Greek, we have 5,800 manuscripts or 5,800 handwritten Greek manuscripts. If you count all languages, it's about 24,000. Again, this is unheard of with most documents. Again, Josephus was doing good, and he has 50. We have 5,800 just in Greek. But, as I said earlier, and Ehrman loves to point this out, he does it with joy, if you take those 5,800 and you put them together, you'll notice there are 400,000 differences. So you don't have the originals, and your copies have 400,000 differences. How do you trust this? I think it's a deceptive way that he argues, because he intentionally leaves out the rest of the story. Again, Ehrman makes a big deal of these variances, or these variants and these differences that we have in our manuscripts. But again, he fails to point out that most of them are completely irrelevant. He says it for sure in some books. I found one quote. Let me read this for you. This is Bart Ehrman again. He says, "To be sure, of all the hundreds of thousands of textual changes found among our manuscripts, most of them are completely insignificant, immaterial, and of no real importance of anything other than showing the scribes could not spell or keep focused any better than the rest of us." And yet he'll whisper that because that would make all his book sales go down. He'd rather just tell you, you got 400,000 differences and you can't trust the Bible because of this, 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 and this. And then in a footnote somewhere, he'll say, and by the way, most of the differences don't matter. So the number I'll give you is, out of 400,000 differences, the conservative number is about 4,000 are what we call significant. And what I mean by significant, it doesn't mean there's a variation on whether Jesus is God or not. That's not what we're talking about. What we mean significant is there's actually something to that variant. It's not so obscure that we should just dismiss it. And again, this will make a lot more sense when we get into the text, but I just want to kind of prep the groundwork for you. When we get to our Bibles in our New Testament, you're going to read a lot of footnotes that'll say some manuscripts add this, some manuscripts put this in this section. You're going to see that in your New Testament, and I want to lay the groundwork for you why that is. It's because in our 5,800 copies, we don't have the autographs, and we have 400,000 differences. So some choices have to be made in translation, and we'll go through a few examples of that tonight. Turn to 1 Thessalonians 2. We'll try that one. Actually, no, 1 Timothy 3. We'll do that. 1 Timothy 3. In the history of these manuscripts, men with far more capabilities than I have examined them and come to the conclusion that there's two big categories of changes. That's the way that we'll word it. There's two big categories of changes, and one of them's going to bother you, and I promise you it'll be okay. We'll get to it. But there are copyist changes that are unintentional, and there are copyist changes that are what? Intentional. They meant to change it. And you go, well, how devious? No, like, we'll get to it. One of the misconceptions about the Bible being copied so often and so early is some people will say, none of them were professional. Others will say all of them were professional. The reality is there was a mixture. And here's the benefit you get with a mixture. The professionals were hired to create a beautiful document. That's what they were thinking. And so when you compare ancient texts, the Greek manuscripts, you can tell when a professional did it. This is, again, according to Dan Wallace, because the calligraphy is really well done. It's uniform. It looks like it flows really well. They gave great detail to the aesthetic issues, right? So what do you think they didn't give as much detail to? If you hired me, and I'm not a Christian, to write a copy of the Bible, I'm going to make it look great. What do you think I'm probably not going to do a great job of? Huh? Yeah, the content. So it may look awesome, but the content's going to have a lot of hiccups in it. And so the professional ones are great to have because they're so well preserved and they look great, but they got a lot more errors in them, if you will, mistakes. The untrained ones didn't look as great. Their handwriting's a little sloppy. The letters vary every now and then, but they're extremely careful and faithful to what was being copied. And so having both of these is a big advantage. There were some that, again, this is Dan Wallace and his crew. There's a whole organization that examines these documents. And they said there's ways that they think they can prove some scribes would take a letter at a time. The professionals would typically take a line or a paragraph, memorize it, and write it. The people who are really concentrating on the content were sometimes taking a letter or a word at the max. And so you can see how tedious that would be. But in the first category, I want to show you some examples. You have the first category, unintentional changes. These are times when people are copying and they, oops, and they may not even catch it. So to help you relax on this a little bit, imagine if you saw my copy of an important U.S. document, and it said this: we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, what would you think? If I turned that into my teacher, what would you think? Since it's me, probably not a fair question. Like, he probably tried to sneak that one by me. Huh? Yeah, what is the onion? Like, clearly, no one else in the class has onion written down. Chances are, I didn't mean to do that. We know it's union. Like, this isn't a big deal. Does that make sense? We know what it's supposed to be. I'm trying to put you at ease here, because on these unintentional changes, because they're unintentional, they usually don't make a lot of sense. And they're really easy to see. If someone wrote, in order to form a more perfect onion, you'd be like, that's obvious. So some of these are pretty obvious. Sometimes with these unintentional errors or unintentional changes, I'm sorry, they would be changes due to sight. So we'll look at 1 Timothy 3 in a second, but have you ever been reading and writing or typing and you look back at the book and your eye goes to the wrong spot, but you don't catch it till later? Raise your hand if you've ever done something like that, right? So that is a common mistake that's obvious. Because you can tell in one copy, he skipped a large section or he repeated it. And so as you're copying, so I'm looking at a line here, the line ends in book. And let's say I write and I look back. And then let's say there's another line that ends in book and my eye catches that one and I start writing again. That's one common one. You can see examples of that in 1 John 2 and 1 Thessalonians 2. There's another one where in Mark 14 there's a variant. And it says they received him with many blows, or they treated him with many blows. And the majority of the manuscripts have the Greek word elabon, and a minor amount of them have ebalon. It's like, well, that's an easy mistake to make. Elabon, ebalon. It's just flipping the B and the L. But the one you're on there, 1 Timothy 3, 16. It's also possible to confuse letters. 1 Timothy 3:16. Great indeed, we confess, is the mystery of godliness. And then what's the first line on that next part? Raise your hand if you have he. Okay, raise your hand if you have something else. What do you have? God. And so here's the charge. The ESV, all you, those new international perversion Bibles, they take God out of the Bible. They just put he where it's supposed to say God. And that's the way people will argue. It's like, hold your horses. The ESV puts a footnote here. It says he, but in the footnote it says Greek, who, some manuscripts, what? God. So in early church, I don't have my pen on me. It's okay. They would have some shorthand phrases. So like I do this in my own notes. Well, we do it in text, right? LOL, things like that. Okay, that's probably a bad example, but you get the picture. We shorten things. Well, in the early church, when there were sacred names being used, they would use shorthand. And one of the ideas was they would put a line, just a dash, above the letter to let you know it was referring to a divine person. So he, in Greek, is this letter. And if I put a line above it, that's he, but they're letting me know that refers to a divine person. The shorthand for God in Greek is the O with a line through it. So did that scribe mean to put the line here, or did he mean to put the line here? Y'all get the difference there? And you got to remember, they're probably writing on what? Leaves. It's like, pen has a tendency to trail a little bit in the grooves, you know? So it's easy to see these kind of mistakes. You've written on a surface before where you want your pen to go one way and the groove on the table takes it another way. cut these guys some slack, right? So in the manuscripts we have, some versions have just the O, and I'm just saying it where we know what we're talking about, and the lines above it to let you know the he is referring to a divine person. Some have taken that O and they've taken the line down here and made it direct reference to God. So that's why the versions that say God, they use manuscripts that have the line down here. The manuscripts that say he, that's what you can tell the ESV and newer versions use. So that is just the common confusion of a letter. Look at 1 Thessalonians 2. Go back to your left. It's not just errors or changes due to sight. It's also changes due to hearing. I'm going to cut these off so you can hear me better, or I can at least hear myself. So here's one where, to give you an English parallel, imagine if I wrote in my paper an napkin or a napkin. Do you see how just the N changes? Okay, did he mean a napkin or did he mean an napkin? Did he mean to write two N's there? And you're trying to figure out what I'm doing here. Look at 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 7. But we were gentle among you, like a nursing mother taking care of her own children. Again, in the ESV, there's a footnote. The footnote, footnote 2 in my Bible, says some manuscripts, they don't say gentle. What do they say? Yeah, so did Paul say we were gentle or we were infants? What did he say? And so, again, you may be sitting there going, that's not a big deal. But it is a big deal if we believe in inspiration, because we believe what God said matters. So we know God either said gentle or children, but we just don't know which one. Okay? So in the Greek, and I'll try to pronounce this as clear as I can, southern accent, trying to speak Greek, see how it goes. But the we were is the word eganathamen. Notice the men ending in. It ends in an N. And the next word is either apioi or napioi. So the confusion is over. Did they mean to put those same two letters back to back? Or is there only supposed to be one? If you take both letters being there, you get the word gentle. If you drop one of the N's for our sake, you get the word little children, infants. It's like, it's just as simple as, did that copyist mean to put the same letter twice? Or did they drop one of them and leave only one letter? And you get two totally different words. And so you can see that. That's why your footnote will say that in 1 Thessalonians 2:7. Another one would be, as I said earlier, a change of due to memory. They would read sections and go and copy. And so a common thing in this is if I'm trying to memorize to copy and I'm memorizing a verse that I have memorized from another book as well that sounds a lot alike, have you ever been quoting one verse and you kind of just accidentally morphed it into another verse? Like, for God so loved the world, there's now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. It's like, what'd you just do? And those kind of mistakes would happen. They would read a passage, and as they go to write it, they would write, and the familiar one would kind of flow out of their thinking. And so that's not hard to understand. Again, that sometimes they would use synonyms. Sometimes they would use different word order. Sometimes they would use different order of letters. Ebalon, Elabon, that kind of thing. Again, every one of those counts. And so that's when you hear the number 400,000, the vast majority of them are just as simple as, should it be an apple or a apple? And that N falls in and out. That's the vast majority of them. Another common unintentional change was one of judgment. Look at John 5. This one is pretty funny. Just because it sounds really godly, but it's not. Don't change the Bible. So John 5. I'm sorry, I was thinking of a different one. We'll get to the other one later. Okay, so imagine, how many of you write in your Bibles? Okay, most of you, right? Okay, so I've got one that I've written all in. Imagine if people are having to handwrite copies of the Bible today, okay? So your handwriting of the text and your handwriting in the notes looks a lot alike, right? Because you wrote both. So imagine, if you will, you're copying John. You get to chapter 7, and all of a sudden, oh boy. Oh man, I forgot back in chapter 5, there's a verse I skipped. I'm not just going to crumple it up and throw it away. Go get me more parchments. Like, that's not how this is going to work. So I'm going to go back to where I made the mistake and write it in the margin, right? Kind of insert here. Well, if I die and you take my Bible and you start copying it, how do you know the difference between my personal notes, my commentaries, and my, oops, I missed that verse there, it should go there? You don't know the difference, right? And so this is why scholars will speak of the New Testament as a growing New Testament, not a shrinking. So often, you're tempted to doubt the New Testament, and you're made to think that you don't have all the pieces. They make you think you're putting together a 1,000-piece puzzle with 900 pieces. Does that make sense? They go, hey, with all these variants, how do you know you have the right thing? And they're making it sound like you've been shortchanged. How do you know the right stuff survived? The reality is our New Testament has grown. Now, the New Testament hasn't grown. I just mean in the copies. Because they were so conservative in their copying, they would throw everything in. And so if someone had a marginal note that was just their own note, and someone wasn't sure, it's like, put it in there. Like, who knows? We'd hate to leave it out. And so rather than putting together a 1,000-piece puzzle with 900 pieces, we're actually putting together a 1,000-piece puzzle with 1,100 pieces. Does that make sense? We have to figure out what actually isn't supposed to be there most of the time. So here's a good example. I'll pick on Colin. Colin, read John 5:4. Anytime. Yeah. So if you're looking for John 5:4, you only have it in your text if you're using probably a King James or New King James. ESV, NASB, the newer versions jump from verse 3 to verse 5. But at the end of verse 3 in the ESV, there's a footnote. A footnote, number 6 in my Bible. It says, if I can find it here. Yeah, some manuscripts insert. So do you hear the extra language? Some manuscripts insert, and then it has that verse about, it's basically a bad way of saying God helps those who help themselves. It's not original. And so here's a passage where John 5:4, that's not in our text, but it's in our footnotes. And so again, you'll have King James only people. They'll go, look at you, your new versions. They're taking verses out of the Bible. What is their assumption here? What is their assumption? That John wrote it. I don't care what your version has. I want to know what John wrote. And so you're assuming John wrote it and we're removing it. What the ESV has decided here, and NASB and newer versions, is John didn't write that. Given the evidence, given the history of that side note, if you will. And there's other ways we could talk through that. But given that, they decide that wasn't original to John. Listen, we're not after the originals. We're not after perfect copies. We're after what was written. If I can get what was written, I don't care if I have the originals. Who cares if I've got the original sheet to a recipe if I've got the original recipe? And so in Scripture, that's what we're fighting for. Look at John 1. There's another one. You had changes due to memory, judgment, and even just say fatigue and carelessness. Often these copyists would copy for 6 hours. It's miserable. And you can even notice, as I said earlier, when some of them would get tired, as you get tired, what do you think starts to happen to your copy? It starts to make less and less sense. And so they can tell where errors started to increase and then they went away. It's like, yeah, he probably went to sleep right here. And then came back the next day. Look at John 1:30. Here's one. It's just as simple as leaving a letter out. And it's not even important enough they give you a footnote. They don't even give you a footnote, I don't think. But John 1:30 says, if I can find it. This is he of whom I said, after me comes a what? a man who ranks before me because he was before me. So John the Baptist is saying this is a man who comes after me, right? Well, in the Greek, the word for man there is aner. So you hear that in, aner. The word for heir, like heir, is aer. So if you just drop the in, you go from aner to aer. And there are some copies that have aer. Now, if you just read that, verse 30, this is he of whom I said, after me comes heir who ranks before me. It's like, that makes no sense. You need to go to bed. And so you can see these copyists having these kind of common unintentional errors. But as I said, and as sad as it is to admit, not everyone made unintentional changes. Some were intentional. And these are harder to detect. Why do you think? Because if you're going to intentionally change something, what are you trying to do? I'm trying to help it. I'm trying to make it make more sense. So I'm going to intentionally change this because I think it needs to be changed. So these are a little harder to detect, but people still are able to do it. Now, I don't want you to misunderstand me. No one, it can't be proven, I guess, no one made intentional mistakes, which I guess is an oxymoron. But they would intentionally change the text. Now, again, to put you at ease, it's not because they thought Paul needed help. What do you think they thought they were changing? If I give you a document that says, look, I copied it in order to form a more perfect onion, what would you change in that sentence? Do what? The word onion. Is that because you think the original document has a problem? No, it's because you think I have a problem. I didn't get it right. And so you're going to help me and fix it. Does that make sense? So these intentional changes weren't because people didn't believe the Bible. They thought they were being more faithful. They thought they were helping the copyist. And so these include areas like spelling and grammar. This is right up my wheelhouse. Imagine if I was copying something and I just wrote ain't somewhere. So I'll do that to Danae sometimes. I'll say, yeah, he said, I ain't doing that. But the person I say that of never uses the word ain't. She's like, I don't think he said that. It's like, well, you know what I mean. And so if I was copying down the conversation and you saw me put the word ain't in for something, I don't know, who does, just raise your hand if you just don't normally use the word ain't. Do you ever use the word ain't? Okay, so if I was copying something she said, Christy said, and I put the word ain't in there, Ryan would look at that and go, look, I know she didn't say this. I'm going to change this to is not, right? So he wouldn't be correcting her. He'd be correcting my copy of what she said. And so there are times where, like English, authors of the New Testament didn't necessarily follow the rules of the day. And so some copyists would come along later and copy it with poor grammar, like it was originally written. And then some later copyists would go, there's no way they said that. Let me help here. And so again, they're changing it not in order to change the Bible, but in order to help clean up other copies. Look at John 4. Try to keep some of these references together. This is one that I was saying earlier is, it's just funny, and the way it's justified is ironic. So this would be an example where someone has really good intentions, but you just shouldn't have done this. John 4, you're not going to see it in English. It's just a Greek order thing, but I'll explain it. Verse 17, the woman answered him, I have no husband. And Jesus said to her, you are right in saying, I have no husband. So in the Greek, the wording is literally, she says, I have no husband. And in Jesus' response, quoting her, he says, a husband, no, I have. And so people say, well, Jesus would not have misquoted her, right? In Greek, it's like Yoda. It's like Yoda sticks out because his word order is weird, you know? In Greek, the word order is not as significant as in English. I'm not saying it's unimportant, but it's not as significant. You can rearrange words, and it's okay. So what the copyist is thinking here, it seems, is, well, Jesus didn't say exactly what she said. So we're going to change what she said to match what Jesus said, because he wouldn't have misquoted her. The copyist must have got her statement wrong, so we'll change her statement to match Jesus, which in English is the same thing. It doesn't really matter. But you can see their thinking here is I'm intentionally changing this so that Jesus isn't misquoting this lady. Look at Luke 5. We're going to have to flip to a few sections here, or two sections here, just to show you this example. Sometimes changes were intentionally made in order to correct what they thought were discrepancies. Look at Luke 5, verse 30. We're going to read this and jump to Mark. Luke 5, verse 30. And the Pharisees and their scribes grumbled at his disciples, saying, "Why do you what? Say it loud. Eat and drink." Okay? Go to Mark 2. Why do you eat and drink? Mark 2, verse 16. And the scribes of the Pharisees, when they saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, said to his disciples, "Why does he what? Eat." Footnote, number 3 in my Bible, some manuscripts add "and drink." So you can see this copyist going, "Man, this joker before me just put eat. Doesn't he know it's supposed to be eat and drink? I'm going to add and drink here to help him out." So again, you can see how these kind of things would creep up. Look at Mark 1, verses 2 to 3. Here's another one. Again, if you have a King James, New King James, it's going to read differently than this, and it makes sense, but it's not correct. In verse 2, as it is written in, what's the book of the Bible there? Isaiah the prophet. Now here's your footnote, verse number 2 in my Bible. Some manuscripts, what do they say? Instead of Isaiah, they say what? In the prophets. Let me explain why. Because the quote is not a quote just from Isaiah. It's a quote from Isaiah and does anybody with a study Bible have the thing there? Let's see, number 2B, Malachi. Yeah, Malachi and Isaiah. That's what it is. So Mark seems to have written as it said in Isaiah and quotes Isaiah but smashes Malachi up there. This is what we call conflation. He just took two quotes and put them together. So let me ask you something. If you were going to help this passage, doesn't it make sense to change Isaiah to the prophets? Does that make sense? That would make more sense of this text. So this is where you get this general rule of thumb. It's not always followed. But they typically like to say which one is a harder reading, that's probably the right one. Because if you're going to intentionally change something, you're going to make it easier. Does that make sense? If I read, as it says in the prophets, and he quotes two prophets, why would I change that to Isaiah? That makes no sense. But if I read, as he says in Isaiah, and he quotes two prophets, or I guess it's just Malachi. I'm sorry. It's not Isaiah and Malachi. Does anybody have a footnote in the study Bible? Is it Malachi and Isaiah or just Malachi? I think it is just Malachi. So the point, again, is it makes no sense to change this to Isaiah. It makes a lot of sense to change it to the prophets. So that's probably the change that they did. Let's go with Isaiah. That's the harder reading. That's probably the right one. So that's some of the ways that they'll logic their way through this. Look at Luke 24. Ryan, what are you reading from? New King James. Okay, this will be helpful here. Luke 24:53. ESV says, "And we're continually in the temple blessing God." That's what most of your versions are going to say. Or NASB says, "Praising God." Is that right, Seth? Well, oh, Malachi. Does anybody use an NASB? Have Luke 24:53. That's what it is. So ESV says blessing, NASB says praising, and check out what New King James does. What does it say? Praising and blessing. Let's get them all in there. Let's just throw it all in there. And so you can see how people would come along, see these differences, and intentionally change it to extra. So they would conflate things, is what we call it. Ephesians 4. Go here. Here's another one. Ryan, I'm not picking on you, but you're our token New King James right now. In the slides, I would normally have them on the screen. But Ephesians 4, here's what they think is an intentional change to help explain. And again, it makes sense, but if it wasn't written, get it out. If it was written, get it in. Ephesians 4, verse 9 says, in saying he ascended, what does it mean but that he also descended into the lower regions of the earth? Probably a reference here to the incarnation. But it says here, before he ascended, he descended. And so if I were explaining this, I would say, look, before he ascended, he first descended. See how I added that word first? He first descended. All right, Ryan, read that verse for me. So the manuscripts that New King James and King James are based on have that word first, what we would consider inserted, they would consider we removed it. Do you see the difference here? Here's another one, Romans 8:1. I got to be honest, I wasn't aware of this one until I was getting ready for this. This is a verse that many people have memorized. And I'd never preached it. I've never looked at it for this reason. And here we go, Romans 8:1. There is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Does yours keep going, Ryan? Yeah, so the footnote in the ESV, some manuscripts add, who walk not according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. And so again, here you have an instance where it seems like someone took some theology from chapter 8 and adds it here in verse 1. Or, if you take the perspective of King James only, they would say, we've removed it. But you can understand why the differences are there. So just in summarizing these, I don't want to go through these all night. Dan Wallace said this. He said, scribes change the text unintentionally, far more common, but also intentionally. Most intentional changes were due to piety or desire for clarification. A major criterion for determining the original wording, therefore, is the harder reading is to be preferred. And again, that's what they're trying to explain. When you have two options, try to put yourself in the copyist mind. And if I'm going to change this, am I likely to make this more confusing or more clear? And so that's why they tend to go with the harder reading. Just to give you, so you're not caught off guard, go to John 7. I want to turn you here only because I just don't want you to be caught off guard. The two largest sections that are debated are John 7:53 through 8:11 and Mark 16:9 to 20. So you'll see here in John 7:53, this is the woman caught in adultery. ESV puts brackets here. Footnote, some manuscripts do not include 753 through 811. Others add the passage here or after 736 or after 2125 or after Luke 2138 with variations to the text. John Piper has a very helpful sermon on this passage, and the title is my favorite passage that's not in the Bible. This is one of those instances where people have a lot of emotional ties to this woman called an adultery. It's a passage that's popular and common. And so when you come to something like this, people think you're attacking their Bible because you're trying to get something like this out. The problem is, if it's not original, I don't want it in. If it is, I want it in. That's what we're trying to settle here. So for many reasons, but as the ESV footnote summarizes, this passage is thought to not be original, mainly because it floats so much. I mean, you look at different manuscripts, and it's either not in it, or it's in various locations. And one time, it pops up in Luke. And so, the best case scenario, it seems like, there are people who think this actually happened, but that's not what we're concerned with inspiration. We don't want all things that happened in the Bible. What do we want? All things that God breathed out. Does that make sense? So, whether or not this happened, in one sense, is irrelevant. Did God breathe it out through John? And modern scholarship would say no. Obviously, if you go with different texts, you say yes. Again, Mark 16, if I were preaching Mark 16, I would stop at verse 8. I would not preach verses 9 to 20. because I can't preach something that I don't think is God's word, even though you can open your Bible and say, it's in my Bible. Well, that's deceptive. I know it's in your Bible, but so are my table of contents, and that didn't come from God either. We've got to be careful with what we mean by it's in my Bible. Again, if I could recommend you to go listen to those two sermons, John Piper on John 7:53 through 8:11, he talks about this issue. And then John MacArthur, when he preached on the book of Mark, he ended the book of Mark on verse 8. And then his last sermon, he preached on why that passage isn't in the Bible. And I remember leaving that sermon going, he's got to be the only human who can tell me my Bible, like that passage isn't in my Bible and I trust my Bible more. It's just odd how that works. And so I would encourage you to go listen to him preach on that passage as well. Let me end with a few words here. In conclusion, we need to rightly understand the doctrine of inspiration. Again, when we say the Bible's inspired, we do not mean the men were inspired. We do not mean the material they used was inspired. We mean the what were inspired. And this is key. What do we mean was inspired? Were the documents inspired? Did God breathe out parchment? They weren't, yes, the words. So again, when people pick on us for not having originals, it's completely irrelevant. I don't care if I have the actual document Paul sent to the Romans. I want the words Paul sent. And if I can get those on a note card, I don't care. That's what's inspired, is the words. Again, I'm not on search for original documents. Words do not lose inspiration because they're copied. If an author emails a copy of his book to be printed, is it no longer his book because they changed the format that it's in? It's still his book. And he's the author of it. We get back again to the more original wording as we compare manuscripts. This is the illustration I want to give you, and it's greatly helped me. Because originally I was of the mindset of, I wish God had just given us one copy. Like, why all these copies? Well, if he ordained that he would give the text and then he would have people copy it, I'm so thankful he has so many copies. And here's the reason. So my mom makes this thing called a chewy cake. And it's kind of like a blondie, but for purposes of our illustration, we'll call it chewy cake. So there's three of us in the family. So let's imagine that my mom gives us the recipe for chewy cake. And we take it to our respective parts of the country. We end up passing it on to our kids, and they branch out. And let's say eventually we find ourselves in the four corners of the United States. And then we have a family reunion, we all come back together, and we compare our recipes. Well, if I added anything to my recipe, how will that be exposed? What will you notice? Yeah. Nobody else has this, Josh. When did you start adding pecans to it? It's like, oh yeah, I did do that. My bad. It's by having more, so you can compare more, that we're doing a better, we're in a better case than if we just had three. An example of this, to use the text, is you remember earlier when I showed you we were gentle or we were infants? Well, there is one copy in church history that has the word for horses there. We were horses among you. Now, aren't you thankful we have thousands of copies? So we can go, dude, you disagree with thousands of copies. If we only had two, and one said infants and one said horses, I don't know. I mean, still in the context, we'll probably go with infants. But This guy copies it and gets horses. And we're able to see that and laugh about it because we have overwhelming evidence that he's crazy. And so again, you don't need to be bashful about how many copies we have. It's good that we have so many copies because now we can compare them and see more clearly than if we just had a few. Again, they'll shoot themselves in the foot by saying there's no way you can know what the original manuscripts are. Or autographs are, And yet the irony is they would have to know what they are to tell us we're wrong about them. If you're going to tell me 2 plus 2 is not 5, the assumption is you know what it is. You can't say no one can know what it is and say I'm wrong. You don't get to play those two cards at the same time. So here's how I'll end it, and this is what I normally present with, but this is just how I'll wrap up tonight. The New Testament is the most has the most evidence of any ancient documents, not even close. The New Testament has the best evidence of any ancient document, again, not even close. And the New Testament has the smallest gap of time between the autographs and the copies. It's not even close. You're talking about 45 years versus 900 years on other documents. So the manuscripts of the New Testament, we have the most, the best, and the smallest gap. These three facts allow us to compare manuscripts that go back to the original wording. At no point was any one group of people in charge of copying the New Testament. So this proves that no massive overhaul of doctrine was possible. You couldn't just insert something. You can't change the recipe and not get caught when we start comparing. Does that make sense? It's not like you're going to have one manuscript that says Jesus is God, none of the other ones do, and I go, come on guys, let's all add it in there. That's not going to happen. Of the 400,000 differences in our New Testament copies, 99% are irrelevant. To give you more accurate numbers, that's 396,000 that are irrelevant. That leaves us with 4,000 that we call credible. And again, none of these affect any major doctrine. None of these cause Christianity to crumble. So this is why we often say in our translation debates, you can be a Christian and hold to many of the translations because their differences don't typically deal with doctrine. So I could preach from a King James the same things I preach from an ESV. I could preach the same exact things because no major doctrine is affected. It's not like we have a passage that there's a variant where there could be a fourth member of the Godhead. But not all manuscripts agree there, so we don't know. There could be three or four. It's not anything like that. It's should Mary have the word thee before her name or not? Okay. Does John have two N's or one? Again, Dan Wallace was talking about, in English, we say Jesus loves Paul. In Greek, there's easily 15 ways that you could write that. If you change a couple other things, because it would translate the same, he starts showing you how there's a couple thousand different ways you could write that same English sentence. And so this is what we mean by irrelevant. It doesn't change what we're trying to translate. And so in summary, God has not only been gracious to give us his word, but he's also been gracious to preserve his word so that we have what I would consider more than enough. We have the New Testament and we have extras, which is why you see your footnotes. Some manuscripts add this or that. So this is a blessing, nothing to be ashamed of, even though Bart Ehrman and them would disagree. So that is it for me tonight. Any questions on that? Anything that was unclear that needs to be clarified? Again, I would refer you to this. What's really helpful in the back is I just turned to this one right here. Here it is on page 316. Mark 1, 2, and 3. Is it Isaiah the prophet or the prophets? And he explains it right here. It's a really helpful book on those issues. Any questions on any of this? What are the two times of the year that you can almost guarantee they're going to find new errors in the Bible and new manuscripts? Start noticing this. Yeah, Christmas and Easter. Every Christmas and Easter, CNN's got some new article on how Jesus really did have a wife or something like that. It's like, man, you guys are really capitalizing on this whole holiday thing. Any other questions or comments? Two lessons of a fire hydrant in a row. We have one more, and ironically, this is the one that got me wanting to teach this class this summer, and I saved it for last. We're going to talk about next week the canon, and that's with one N, not two. So not boom, but canon. How do we know we have the right books? We'll talk about that council that got together and decided what books should go in the Bible. It doesn't exist, but anyway, let me pray for us.